Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. It was another busy week for the Public Accounts Committee, and on Thursday, Garda Commissioner Martin Callanan was before the committee to answer questions relating to the quashing of fines and penalty points. Throughout the day on Thursday, a number of programmes played excerpts from the hearing, and on Fridays, today with Sean O'Rourke, we heard this exchange between the Commissioner and Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald after the Deputy asked how many Gardaí had accessed the confidential information reporting system.
Why is it that you wouldn't give us a number?
This is a confidential reporting mechanism. We've been through this several times.
No, we haven't, and I've made very clear to you that I'm not looking for the detail or the identity.
But you know my position on it, Deputy, to be fair.
Your position is not to tell us, and I find that troubling.
My position hasn't altered, Deputy. That's as much as I can say to you. Yeah.
That's not very transparent, is it?
Well, you know, to be fair, there is an annual report forwarded to the Minister in relation to this area. I'm obliged to do that.
So you're telling me to ask a parliamentary question rather than to annoy you?
Deputy, you're well capable of doing your own business. I wouldn't ever suggest to you how to conduct your business.
From Fridays Today with Sean O'Rourke. Also on Friday morning, another member of the Public Accounts Committee, Shane Ross, spoke on Morning Ireland about the contribution made by the Garda Commissioner. And here he talks about exchanges relating to the role of whistleblowers.
I thought it was quite extraordinary. Yeah, the Commissioner said that. He said it shouldn't be used as a platform. He went on to say the matters of such importance should not be discussed here. He was almost disdainful of the Public Accounts Committee, which is, after all, a democratic forum. He then went on to say that they should be dealt with me, myself, meaning that he was important enough to have it, but that we weren't. I think that it's a great pity that he used such language. And he went on to talk about being usurped by subordinates, which was an extraordinary phrase to use, again, regarding his subordinates, as he calls them, as somewhere being second-class citizens, when they have every right to express a view, an opinion, and to give evidence in public. You know, they have. They did say, and they have said quite openly, they tried the confidential method, which there is open to them in the Garda Force, and they found it unsatisfactory. So what option? What other option is there open to them? We don't. This must not be misinterpreted, by the way, by the Garda Commissioner, as the PAC having some sort of hunt against him. We want to see the whistleblowers, and we want to challenge them just in exactly the same way, and challenge their evidence in exactly the same way as we've challenged the Garda Commissioner yesterday. We want to give fair play to everybody. We want it done in public.
The problem is this, surely, whatever about the law, which will be decided elsewhere, obviously. But the problem is that you're not even responsible for the Gardaí as a committee, nor are you responsible for Garda discipline. The Garda Commissioner is somebody who comes before you because he is the accounting officer. He's responsible for what happens to the money. These people are effectively responsible for nothing in Public Accounts Committee terms. They're just ordinary members of the Gardaí.
Yeah, but
and therefore, should you go that far into an organisation which the Commissioner runs, like the head of any organisation runs?
Absolutely. It's absolutely vital that very powerful people, like the Commissioner, and he's a very powerful person, should be answerable to public representatives. But I think we have been led into this by the fact that the whistleblowers have come to us with this evidence. It would be absolute derogation of our duty as public representatives, the voice of the people, if we did not challenge the Gardaí and challenge the whistleblowers, but right, deal with this evidence in a balanced and a very responsible way.
It's going to be decided in court, isn't it, whether you go ahead with this?
I think it would be very, very a great pity if the Garda Commissioner didn't say, look, I think that this should be thrashed out in public. Yeah. I have nothing to fear. I'm in favour of open democracy, which he obviously isn't. And decides not to go to court. If he threatens us with going to court, I think we'll put up a pretty robust defence.
Shane Ross talking to Cathal McQuilla on Friday's Morning Ireland. Retired Garda John Wilson is one of the two whistleblowers which the Public Accounts Committee is hoping to interview. He was also featured in last Saturday's documentary On One, in which he spoke about his 30-year career in the Gardaí and the events which he believes resulted in a dead rat being tied to his front door. Here he tells documentary maker Robert Mulhern about how he went public about his allegations relating to ticket fixing within the Gardaí.
I made a complaint in relation to a small number of terminations that I believed were corrupt. The other man emailed Enda Kenny's office, and he emailed a few more government departments as well, outlining very, very serious allegations in relation to the ticket fix. You know, months went past. I waited.
And waited. He got fed up waiting and decided to take his allegations to independent TD Claire Daly.
What's going on, Claire Daly? What do you think?
Well, I don't know, but certainly the scale of the documentation that we've seen is that really this is a systematic ticket-fixing scandal, really, where it's almost now considered to be a perk of the job, where if you know a Garda, you can get
penalty. In the aftermath of that broadcast, to use that old vernacular saying that the shit hit the fan in Garda headquarters, they launched an immediate inquiry. It was to find out who the whistleblowers were, basically.
The name soon came out, and even though John wanted to stay anonymous, he was identified within the Gardaí as a whistleblower.
I walked into a little kitchen not far from the main public office, and there were a number of people that I would have joked with and chatted with, and you know, I would have been known as a messer, you know. And there were about, I think there were three people, and when I walked in, two of them got up and left. There was a third person there, and this person stood up and just looked at me and said, "Stones and glass houses," and walked out. You know, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. In other words, kind of pointing a finger at me, you know. And I found that day, I found that very, very hurtful.
John also described how after 30 years as a serving Garda, he eventually decided to retire.
A career that I loved. A job that I loved doing. And it was no longer tenable. I couldn't take it anymore. So I went back to the station, and a couple of hours later, I went sick in the book. I got onto Monaghan, and I went sick with work-related stress, bullying and harassment. That's what I put down, on the bottom of the forum. And I went home anyway, and it was, you know, is this the way my career is going to end? I mean, I'd done nothing wrong. I mean, I had reported corruption. For Christ's sake, corruption. We are the police force in the country. And I just had a chat with my family and whatever, and I decided to apply to go.
Retired Garda John Wilson talking to Robert Mulhern on last Saturday's documentary on One, The Garda Who Limped, produced by Ronan Kelly. The implication of last week's Public Accounts Committee revelations relating to the CRC were discussed on Wednesday's late debate with Brian Dowling, with Fergus Finlay, the CEO of Barnardo's, and Jim Clarkin, the CEO of Oxfam. In this excerpt, Jim Clarkin discusses the issue of transparency.
I mean, the longer these stories continue, and the concern about the lack of transparency, and I think that's the bit that hurts the most, the lack of transparency. When, as Fergus says, we're all absolutely obliged to be transparent. We're contractually bound to be transparent, but we're morally bound to be transparent too. At the end of the day, this is public money. This is not the charity's money. This is the money that we are given, whether it be by the state or by the public. Ultimately, it comes from the public, and we're entrusted with that money to do important work on their behalf. And if that trust is undermined, then that's a big problem. So what we need to do is to ensure that these are exceptional cases, and that we start to highlight the fact that this is not common practice or common behaviour across the charitable sector. These are the exceptions, and it's the PAC are doing very important work, but hopefully it'll get to the point, the story will get to the point where we start to highlight the fact that good practice is happening in the vast majority of cases.
Brian also asked Fergus Finlay about the impact of the revelations regarding the salaries of other executives in the charitable sector.
There are people in these organisations right across the sector who are living in, you know, a world that doesn't exist anymore. They were not in sort of Celtic Tiger Ireland where everybody was making a million and all of that. And people who are very, very hard-pressed have every right to be angry. What makes the rest of us angry, I think, is that we all get then tarred with the same brush. I mean, you know, Jim and other organisations like Jim's and mine and so on, we depend on the trust of the public. And when you're getting, as we get, 30, 40 questions a day from people who want to donate and want to contribute, but want to be reassured
of where their money is going.
Unfortunately, we can direct them to, you know, a website that is as clean as a whistle and you know, where they will get answers to every single question they have.
And the public view, I think, Fergus, is that for better or for worse, the public want to see issues such as the chief executive salaries across all these organisations out in the open.
Yes. Mm.
And I think, I know, Jim, I think you're quite clear about your salary at €100,000.
And it's there, it's in the public domain, it's on the website, it's anywhere anybody wants to look.
Yeah, my salary is €111,000. It has been a matter of public record since the day I was appointed.
From Wednesday's late debate. It's a year to the day since Detective Garda Adrian Donoghue was shot dead outside Lordship Credit Union, just yards from the school where his two children attend and a mile from his own home. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, Cathy Farrell reported from Dundalk, where the community is still coming to terms with the loss of such a vibrant and much-loved member of their town.
It was a very bad night. It was obviously dark at that time of night, January night. It was cold, very windy, very, very wet. Rained all day. Certain roads were flooded, actually, on the peninsula that night.
Alan Duffy, chairman of St Patrick's Gaelic Football Club, remembers clearly the night a year ago when Detective Garda Adrian Donoghue was shot dead. Adrian played and coached at St Pat's.
Parents were collecting the kids from the door, and there were certain, you know, snippets of information coming in that there was a robbery at the credit union in Lordship.
Alan was in St Pat's that night attending a youth function in the community centre, which is just down the road from Lordship Credit Union.
Somebody said the shots were fired, and then somebody said a guard was shot, and then I went on to say somebody mentioned Adrian.
While the names of those involved in the brutal murder were quickly known to Gardaí, 1 year on, charges have yet to be brought against those involved, adding to the anguish of his family and the local community.
This was a major shock to the whole community, and I know that area. Particularly through that area every day, represent the people of that area.
Jim Loughran is a Sinn Féin councillor for Dundalk Carlingford.
And as I say, people would be concerned that the longer it goes on and nobody brought to justice, people would be concerned.
Another local representative, the Fine Gael TD for Louth, Peter Fitzpatrick, played football with Adrian. He says it's hugely important that anyone with any information come forward.
These people murdered a husband, they murdered a father, the more of the volunteer in the area. Like apart from being a guard, Adrian was one of the nicest people you ever come across. Like, you know, and he was a fantastic ambassador for the guards. But listen, it's so, so important that we Irish people cannot let these murders away, whether they come from the Republic of Ireland or come from Northern Ireland or wherever they come from at the moment. It's important that these people are caught. And if there's someone out there at the moment that has information that can convict these people, please come forward.
A tough weekend lies ahead for Garda Donoghue's wife Caroline, their two young children, his parents and their wider family. But the community of Jenkinstown will be behind them and beside them, keeping his memory alive.
Remember Thursday nights in the summer, 7 o'clock, Adrian would come through a hole in the hedge into the field with two bags on his back and all the gear. And there'd be about 70 children there. And they'd be up to his knees, and he'd have a pair of white shorts on him, and they'd be running around after him. That's the image I will have of him. Take the time on Saturday evening to remember Adrian. The need to understand the mark of the man that was Adrian Donoghue.
From Cathy Farrell's report on Thursday's Morning Ireland. You might remember the very moving and very pointed homily which Redemptorist priest Father Michael Cusack delivered at Garda Donoghue's funeral mass. In it, he beseeched anyone who knew anything about his killing to come forward to Gardaí. On Friday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, Father Cusack reiterated that plea.
People can feel, well, that's none of my business. Well, I'd have to say it's everybody's business, it's in everybody's interest, and I know that the Gardaí will be working with every fibre of their being to try and bring someone to justice for this case.
Now, I suspect a lot of people will have been surprised, some shocked, some pleasantly surprised, by your own references to the law and order situation, referring to your parents living in rural Galway and what happened to older people there with the removal of Gardaí and the closure of small stations. What are your thoughts now, in hindsight? Do you have any regrets about venturing onto that territory at a funeral?
I don't at all, no. It wasn't. I think some people tried to interpret it like as if I had some sort of political plan in place. I just worked at the homily on that day to try and speak to the reality that was before me. And I think that was what God directed me to do on that day, and that I don't mean to make that sound any way too pious at all, but when we're dealing with the reality that has caused so much pain and so much fear, all we can do is speak out as honestly as we can about it, and that is the reality, and I suppose continues to be the reality in the country, that there are many people who live in fear, and there are many people who miss that Garda presence in their community. Why that is, or the politics that are involved in those decisions, maybe is another day's thinking. But for me, on the day, I said what I believed to be right for me, and I think also, I mean, while there were one or two people who did communicate with me afterwards, saying that I was somehow making a political issue, there were. I'd say 99.9% of those who made contact, and there were very many people, felt that in so many ways the sermon on that day spoke for them, particularly for the people of Dundalk, for the people, for the family, for the Gardaí, for those who themselves had felt in some way violated by this terrible act.
Father Michael Cusack talking to Sean O'Rourke on Friday. All this week on Liveline, we heard about incidents in which people had been the victim of random and often catastrophic violent assaults, both in Australia and at home here in Ireland. On Tuesday, Sarah described the impact which one such assault has had on her husband.
He was walking with three other friends to their accommodation, and a guy just came from nowhere, punched him. Say he, my husband didn't see the man punching him, and he hit him in the face, maybe from the side, and knocked him backwards. There was no altercation, there was no fight, there was absolutely nothing. So there were very few witnesses to see the guy. And when my husband was on the ground, the culprit ran off and hasn't been caught or anything. I was actually 7 months pregnant at the time, and when I saw him in the hospital, I got such a fright that he wasn't able to speak to me. He completely blanked me nearly. He didn't realise what was going on. All he wanted to do was go home. I fainted myself then and ended up being taken into A&E for.
And what, you fainted at the sight of him?
No, afterwards, I went out of the room, and I was lucky enough that I had my sisters with me at the time, and I fainted after seeing him. I suppose from the stress of the whole incident, from hearing what had happened, and just after seeing him and the state that he was left in, you know, I got such a fright that
he wasn't able to speak, as you say, or function properly. So you were thinking this is very, very serious.
Absolutely, and at the time, yes, of course, at the time, I suppose I didn't realise how serious it was, and I was just told it'll take time, you know, the doctors and nurses were saying to me, it'll take time, you know, and all I wanted to know was, when is my husband going to be back, you know, when would I have my husband back, would I have my husband back before my baby was born, you know, or would I have two babies come the birth of my child? He wasn't able to string a sentence together. He was speaking, but it was sounds that were coming out, and the sounds had no relationship to the words he was trying to say either. So he was trying to communicate to me, communicate basic needs, like he needed to tie his laces or, you know, needed a drink of water, but I had no idea what he actually wanted. It was just complete baby talk that was coming out of his mouth. So that lasted for a few days. By the time he was released from the hospital, those incidences were much less. So throughout the summer then we had periods where he would be absolutely normal and completely himself, and then other periods where he would be having these kind of what they could possibly be described as seizures, where he would only be able to speak in sounds. And that went on to it. And he was having a lot of frustration then as well, obviously from the impact and not able to express his needs. You know, it was just a very, very difficult time.
This happened last June. How is he now?
Well, we're still dealing with the incident on a daily basis, you know, the effects of it, because the brain takes such a long time to heal that the emotions aren't back to normal yet. You know, he's dealing with different ways of expressing the emotions. So it's still very hard, and even the psychological effect of being hit like that out of nowhere has a huge impact on him.
Sarah, a caller to Tuesday's Liveline. Another story which made the news this week was the payout of what is estimated to be in excess of €2 million by bookies after a bet was placed on four horses at three different racecourses in Britain. All four horses have an association of some description with renowned Irish gambler Barney Curley. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, bookmaker Paddy Power spoke to Des Cahill.
Morning, Des. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. How are you, Morbid? It's not often you get caught. I thought the system wouldn't allow it, Paddy.
Well, you'd cotton on early, like you said there in the report. But it's the thing is, I mean, it just gathers pace, and people say, and then once the words Barney Curley are mentioned, even alleged mentioned as associated to people, just follow in and pile in. So I mean, you know, very few people probably got on at the very top of the market, but at the same time, it just gathers pace. And you know what? The only thing I'm sick as a parrot about is that I wasn't on myself, to be honest with you. I mean, it's a proper good old fashioned gamble. I mean, this is what the game's about. You know what I mean? Pulling off these coups and taking the bookie's pants down.
I hear some tears in the background. That's not a shareholder, is it?
No, I don't think so. No.
Tell me, do you need an army of people to go around putting on small bets, or can somebody put on a big bet to do this?
It's usually a combination of relatively small bets. But on this one, like you said, the odds were so big. So even at kind of mid-morning yesterday, if you did a €5 Yankee, which would cost you £55 to put on all the combinations of horses, that would have got you €14,000. Do you know what I mean? So there's like the odds were so good, and obviously that, you know, plenty can go wrong. I mean, you can be sure they had it all lined up, and the horses had plenty in hand of the handicapper, as they say in inverted commas. But at the same time, there's no such thing as a certainty. So although they chance something would go wrong, but none of them really were under too much pressure, to be honest.
No, and Barney Curley linked to this. He's refusing to talk. Have you any comment on?
Barney Curley is a legendary gambler, isn't he? He's legendary for pulling off these mad coups, and whether he's involved in this or not, I mean, some of the horses have a link to him previously. I'm not sure if we'll ever find out, but I love the quote from one of the owners and one of the horses saying, "No, I didn't back him myself. I don't know why there was a gamble on him." I'm sure you didn't, like, you know. I think it's just a good old-fashioned coup. You shouldn't be having too much sympathy for the bookies, to be honest with you.
Well, I don't know who is, but I mean, inadvertently, is it actually good for the bookies?
Well, I think I think everybody loves to see it, and everybody loves to see it. And if you're on yourself, great. And even if you weren't on, you're going to have fair play to them. Do you know what I mean? And that's what racing's about. And that's what the game is about. It's getting one over on the bookies. And, you know, I think in one way you could say that's good for the game, but it's probably hard enough to explain that to a poor old traders today.
I would imagine so. Paddy, thank you very much for joining us today.
More sympathy for Paddy dealing with the crying child.
The crying child, yeah. Well,
bookies' children cry too, eh?
Paddy Power talking to Des Cahill on Thursday's Morning Ireland, along with Morning Ireland presenter Claire Byrne, who, as the mother of a young baby, is also obviously very familiar with the sweet sound of a crying infant. 50-year-old Tamara was a guest on The Mooney Show on Tuesday. Born a boy, but with intersex syndrome, which means that she had both male and female genitals, she recently had surgery to have her male organs removed. At this point, in what was a particularly candid interview, Tamara tells Derek and Brenda about her relationship with her 18-year-old daughter. She says that she cherishes the time that they spend on their regular car journeys together.
It's an hour driving up and down that we get to spend and talk. And how many other times do you get to sit to talk to your teenage daughter or son for an hour? You know what I mean?
No, you're spending quality time
and
together.
You're spending
which is
quality
very
time, and we talk about the most absurd things. And we've got a great relationship because we've communicated always. Hmm. So from the time she was around six, we had this hour in the morning or in the evening coming up and down where we would be talking.
That's
and
fantastic.
Discussing. And she's very open about it. And I'm sure recently she told me. Two things happened where she was around. One, we were coming up on the way up on a Sunday evening, dropping her to her mum's, and she was in the car when I was stopped at a Garda checkpoint. And the Garda check, yeah, they were dipping for green diesel, and they were dipping for, you know, or checking for drink driving and road tax and insurance. Oh, one of these multifunctional checkpoints. Well, I got stopped by the guard, and the guard said to me, "I can see your license." So I gave him my license, and he said, "This is your wife's, you see?" And I said, "No, I don't have a wife." And he said, "No, well, this is your girlfriend's." And I said, "No, it's not. It's mine." And he looked at it. He looked at me. Because depending how my hair is and my appearance, I was probably looking very androgynous at the time or whatever. And I explained to him. I said, "Look, I have an intersex condition and explain to him that I'm...
You said there while he was standing at the window.
Why is that at the window? And my daughter's sitting there laughing. She's smiling, right? And
He's just at a temple ball, just, God love him. But he wasn't far off it. They never trained for this.
He wasn't far off it, right? And he got so red, okay? He just handed me back the driver's license. He says, thank you, ma'am, sir, whatever. You can go. And I drove off and... My daughter just said, as you drove away, that was like something out of Father Ted, Dad. Yeah.
Tamara, as heard on Tuesday's Mooney. This week, 2 years ago, Martin Fagan was banned from running after he tested positive in the US for using the blood-boosting drug EPO. He's now 30 years of age, is back living in Mullingar and has served out his two-year ban. On last week's Sunday Sport, he spoke to Greg Allen about life since the ban and his hopes and dreams for the future.
I would love to compete for Ireland again, but like, it would really be only if I had a backing of other athletes, you know. And again, I would completely understand if they didn't want to run with me, because unfortunately, being a cheat will always, I believe, will always stay with me. It's going to define my running career, unfortunately, which it is sad, because I know a lot of my results, they're all... in a way tarnished, you know, regardless of how I explain events, you know, people will always say, well, maybe he was always on drugs, and I understand that, and I'm just going to have to hopefully get over that.
Was the occasion a one-off occasion? Can we look at that Irish half marathon record and say that was done by a clean Martin Fagan?
Yes, completely. Like, I mean, again, it's really only my word against, unfortunately, it doesn't matter what I say, like, my whole career is tarnished regardless.
Runner Martin Fagan talking to Greg Allen on Sunday Sport. Last Saturday's Irish Times published an article by Fintan O'Toole which detailed some damning criticisms made by an assessment panel appointed by the Abbey Theatre of work produced at the theatre. On Monday's Arena, artistic director Fiach McNeil told Evelyn O'Rourke about his reaction to what Evelyn described as the chaos caused by the release of the assessment document.
The chaos is the Arts Council released these documents without the process being complete. The Arts
when
Council,
you went to them and said, please don't release
yes.
them, what was their response
they,
to you?
They said to me that under the Freedom of Information legislation, that they had no option but to do that. Now, I said to them, this process isn't complete. So it's like delivering a half diagnosis. So I pleaded with them not to release the document, because I felt that the Arts Council have a duty of care to artists, right?
And as then, you have, but you now are in a situation where you've created maybe a monster. I mean, was it naive of you maybe to think that this word wouldn't leak out, that these reports wouldn't somehow make their way?
At all.
Did you understand they were subject to freedom of information?
No, I didn't understand it, because and I didn't understand that they were subject to, and neither did the assessors. Well, clearly, the second thing I said to the Arts Council, after I plead them not to release them. Now, the issue is, I'm not afraid of assessments. They're important. Releasing a document at the end of a process is a good thing. This process is in mid-flow. So therefore, for the Arts Council to release these documents to the Irish Times, and I explained this to the Irish Times, explained to the journalists during the week when the journalists approached me, when I indeed approached a journalist about this, I said, look, actually, you need to understand the wider context of this. You understand that this is only halfway through the process, that the Abbey haven't given a response, and that wasn't heeded.
Well, for you then, sitting here tonight, I mean, you are presumably dealing and fielding phone calls from the theatre makers who've been named individually, different directors and writers. And I mean, some of the commentary about their productions are pretty damaging, I suppose. For example, the Plough and the Star revival was described as being below level, that the member would have expected a long and wasted night, which made me question why this play was being revived. These are very harsh questions for the people involved in these productions. Where are you standing in the middle of all this? I mean, is your role compromised? Is your authority affected? How are you steering at this
point? Shoulder to shoulder with every single actor, writer, director, designer and production that I produced over the last couple of years. I have nothing but pride and a sense of great humiliation of working with all these, or humbleness rather, working with all these artists. What the Arts Council should have done, which I asked them to do, was to redact all the names of all actors, writers, and they didn't do that.
How angry are you that they haven't done that?
Well, I am. First of all, I think there was a cruel sense of publishing them in the first place. I thought the paper, the Irish Times, had published it knowing full well that the process wasn't concluded and they should have made that comment.
Fiach Mac Eanil talking to Evelyn O'Rourke on Monday's Arena. Later in that same programme, Evelyn also spoke to Fintan O'Toole.
Well, we didn't name any actors. Again, Fiach was wrong about this. He said that the names of individuals were not redacted. So I think people can go online, and I would invite people to go online. They're on the Irish Times website. You can go look at them. They are redacted. And we didn't name any individuals in relation to this. Obviously, the names of writers are going to be attached to their plays, and obviously people can judge who the directors of plays were.
But Fintan, you knew the impact these would have. I mean, you know, they're page-turning, the reviews, some of them, you know, the comments that are there. Did this word cruel, do you not think, or do you accept at all Fiach's line that it is cruel to do this to those theatre makers?
Well, hold on. I mean, who did it? Like, I didn't do this to anybody. Let's be clear about this. This is a process that Fiach initiated. He's a very intelligent, very capable man. He's a member of the Senate, by the way, as well. So he actually, you know, he knows how public life works. He knew that these reports were going to be published when he commissioned them. The only difference here between himself and myself seems to be on timing. He says they should have been published at the end of the process, although that end point is unclear. I think it was perfectly reasonable to publish them after 12 productions have been commented on. But the cruelty, if there is cruelty, would apply anyway. So the cruelty is implicit in the process. I mean, let's just be clear, if people haven't seen this, the Irish Times did not comment in any way on these. I didn't comment myself in any way on any of these. We're simply relaying to the public what a publicly funded process has said. Is this really nasty and difficult for some of the people involved? Absolutely it is. But the responsibility for that lies with the people who commissioned these reviews, knowing if they had any intelligence that they would be published.
Fintan O'Toole, as heard on Monday's Arena. The press conference to announce that Garth Brooks is to play Croke Park this summer received lots of attention on news bulletins and news and magazine programmes on the airwaves this week. Why? Well, in case you haven't heard, it's because the biggest solo-selling artist of all time has decided to unretire and give the business of selling out stadiums one more go. When John Murray interviewed him on Tuesday, he asked him to recall how he first got an inkling that he was headed for the big time.
It's 1990. I'm driving home from the studio. I'm in my red pickup. And the great thing I remember about the red pickup was the sound system was so crappy in it that everything was the whole time. And this DJ goes, I don't know if in my entire career I've ever had more requests for a song than this one here. And you're going, oh, please, could it be something that I have something to do with? And it started the opening lick of Friends in Low Places. And I think that's when I went, oh, wow, this is really cool. Another time we're playing Cowboys down in Dallas. It's a club that we had played four or five times in our career so far. Kelly, my brother, was out with us. He was doing all the financial stuff. And he would carry this clicker that counted people. Now, Cowboys held just about 2,000 people. It was a big dance hall. It's a great place to play. And he came in and he showed me the clicker. And it said 1,500 and something people. And I said, wow, I thought this place held 2,000 people. He goes, Garth, it does. This is how many people are outside. He said, you're going to have to move to arenas, which I didn't want to because I love the bars. Bars is a great place. So I think those two dates stick really close in my mind because you're very lucky to get to play for more people. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you're scared to death it's not going to be intimate the more you get. But this place, Croke Park, changed all that for me. It showed me that you could play to a ton of people and still feel like you're talking to each one of them individually.
There's an intimacy there.
Yeah.
And you got very emotional this morning when you were talking about your return to the music.
I got to tell you, I held it together this morning really well.
You were on the verge of tears. Yeah.
I was proud of how I didn't bawl like a baby this morning because this is big for me.
Garth Brooks talking to John Murray on Tuesday. And later in the show, as part of a competition to win two tickets to one of the Croke Park gigs, John spoke to Barry. Although Barry is a big fan of the man who sings I've Got Friends in Low Places, he himself works in very high places, on top of a crane.
It's about 250 feet up. And looking down here, it's absolutely fantastic.
And where
it's great to be on your show.
Where is the crane, Barry?
Oh, it's in Sowers out in County Dublin. It's in the... You don't call it sewage, you call it the water treatment plant.
And obviously you're taking a tea break to take this call from us this morning, Barry. And actually, if anybody's in Swords and they can see the crane, maybe give Barry a wave.
Don't give me a wave. It's too dangerous.
So, anyway,
getting back to the Garth Brooks, absolutely crazy about him. My wife keeps saying to me, "You'll have to bring me over to Las Vegas to Wynn's Hotel," and I say, "I'm a crane driver. I don't own the crane." I'm just hoping that Seamus McGovern doesn't hear me on the radio. He'll probably have me fired.
He's your boss.
He's my boss. Yeah. I only started here.
Barry, go on now. Give us a few lines of the dance.
So you have to shout at me because so I'll just keep singing and you can just ignore me. Then I'll want to get back to you.
Yes, you can sing for the next 10 minutes.
Looking back on the memory of the dance we shared beneath the stars above. For a moment, all the world was right. How could I have known that you'd ever say goodbye? And I'm glad I didn't know the way it all would end, the way it all would go. Our lives are better left to chance. I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance.
Wonderful. Holding
you. Barry singing The Dance on top of a 250-foot crane on Tuesday's John Murray Show. This Sunday is National Holocaust Memorial Day, and to mark that event, Friday's Godslot aired a report by Rona Tarrant, recorded at one of Germany's most notorious concentration camps.
To get to Buchenwald, you'll need to take a train to Weimar, a town in the heart of Germany. It's traditional, colourful and busy, and the camp itself is just outside the town, a short journey through a forest and up a mountain. On the bus that passes the camp, there's some people with grocery bags and some children going to school. The site seems like such a normal part of the town that it's hard to imagine that this is one of the most infamous concentration camps, second only to Auschwitz in the horrors imposed on the prisoners. It's January when we arrive, so the place is covered in a blanket of snow. Unlike the town, it's cold and quiet, with only a few visitors.
I think it's good that nature can take over again. Even places which had been a place of murder or so. Otherwise, we would live in a huge desert here in Europe.
That's Daniel Gida, director of education here.
This was 37 then, and Dachau was 33. And this was done on plan, just beside a quarry in the middle of a forest. So somehow hidden, and on the other side also, not far away from the city. And therefore, it was a clear threat to everyone, a danger. So be careful, don't speak up against the government, otherwise they will take you up the hill and you will not return.
And for the Nazis, the contradiction between culture and torture didn't exist.
They would say it is a necessary part of our society to have camps, to make sure that we can go into the National Theatre downtown in Weimar and having no Jewish melody and no Jewish musicians and no Jewish actors on stage, it is necessary to have a camp to make that cut.
But this camp wasn't just for Jews. Thousands of so-called communists and criminals passed through the narrow steel gates.
The text says in German, "Jedem das Seine," each for his own, would be a fair translation. It's originally not Nazi text, it's Roman law, saying everyone shall enjoy his property, his type of living. So we do not know exactly why the commander ordered to take that text into the gate. It's not Arbeit macht frei, work makes you free, like it is in Dachau or in Auschwitz. But it was clear that it would be felt as a very cynical comment. Why you were born Jewish or why you are a communist, so this is what you deserve to suffer in the camp.
From Rona Tarrant's report on Friday's Godslot. All this week on Drive Time, Fergal Keane was visiting courthouses around the country. On Thursday, he was in Connemara and he told Mary Wilson about one of the 75 cases which came before Clifton District Court that morning.
It was a civil case involving two farmers from Inishbofin Island off the coast of Connemara. And today, it was the last day of a case which had been running for some time. Now, local Garda Inspector Sean Glenn, he gave details of the case to the court. He said it was a civil dispute involving the ownership of 10 sheep, which they had been grazing on commonage on the island, but both farmers claimed ownership of the sheep. Now, neither would concede, and the dispute went to court last November. Then, at that time, the judge ordered the Gardaí to take the sheep from the island into their custody, these 10 sheep, and Inspector Glenn said the sheep were held in the customs yard in the town and then sold at the mart in the town on the 21st of December on the orders of the court. Now, they fetched a price of €403.65 at the mart, but when feed and vet expenses of €225 were deducted, there was €178.65 yet left. So the hearing today was to decide where the money went. Now, the Gardaí and the judge were of the belief that each of the two farmers was to get €89.32 from the sale, but the farmers were disputing this. So, unbelievably, each farmer was represented in court today. One just had a solicitor, but another had a barrister.
You're kidding me.
In full regalia. The only saving grace was that it was just a junior counsel. But he was in court today, and he said, the junior counsel said, his instructions were that today's hearing was to decide who got the full amount, not that the amount was to be split, this €178.65. And after much discussion, it was announced or decided that the €178.65 was to be taken by both legal firms to see if they could determine what happened to it and whether or not each was going to get €89.32 each. But it was agreed after some discussion that should there not be a determination, either party could then return to court at some later stage if they weren't happy, but the cost in that case must be really considerable.
I was going to say that money will be well used up by the lawyers
so
involved.
As people said to me after, those two parties are going to end up in the negative.
Fergal Keane reporting on Thursday's Drive Time with Mary Wilson. From sheep to cats and dogs. Also on Thursday, we had a story about two cats called Cookie and Indy and a Jack Russell called Millie. It's one of those stories which I'm still not sure whether I find it more cute or creepy. Have a listen and see what you think.
Okay, here we go, Brenda.
Oh my God, that's extraordinary. Can you explain to people what has just happened there?
I have a footstool in the middle of the kitchen and the cat's asleep on it, and Millie has just decided she wants to feed the cat. So she jumped up beside her and now we're having dinner or breakfast.
I'm seeing it live. The cat actually taking milk from the dog. That is phenomenal. And look, the dog is pawing her to get her to do it again. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the dog who always instigates. Oh, this is Millie wanting to feed her. She's just, it's like she talks to her going, come on, have a little drink. And now she's just thinking about it.
Millie has got her paw on the back of the cat trying to get her to turn around.
She's trying to get her attention. This is what she does, and she will do laps of the cat if she wants to feed her and kind of bring her to the bed. And the cat normally follows and has a drink.
And does Millie now get frustrated that the cat doesn't want to be fed?
No. She might follow her if she, she might, sometimes will follow her and annoy her, but no, she'll just leave her alone. This is just normal in my kitchen.
When the cat is feeding, I could see the head was going right
and
in.
The paws, yeah. She like massages her tummy. I'd say the dog likes that. Maybe that's why. Say if she hadn't been feeding when she started, it'll take her about 2 days. You'll notice the dog acting a bit odd, and within 2 days she'll have the cat sucking. She just torments her into it, I think.
And is it both cats that suck up here?
Yeah, both of them. Yeah, they don't seem to. She doesn't seem to care. She doesn't have a favourite.
Does she ever do two at the same time?
She used to, but not anymore. No, now it's one. But the cats are nearly as big as her. She's only tiny. Mm. So there's not a room in any bed for two cats and a dog.
So what do you think the cats and the dog get out of the whole experience?
I really don't know. I think Millie is very, she's very much a mammy. She loves to mammy the cats and she cleans them and she'll clean their ears. But apart from that, I don't see what she gets out of it. I often wonder, is it bad for her? But so you can ask Andrew the vet that.
In what way? That it's draining her?
Yeah, exactly. Because she's old, she's 10. But she loves her cats.
Brenda Donoghue reporting on Thursday's Mooney. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, Johnny Doohan was a guest in the John Murray Show on Friday. I'm Fiona Kelly. This is The Voyage. So until next week, goodbye.
I am a sailor and you're my first mate. We signed on together, coupled our fate. hauled up our anchor, determined not to fail. For the heart's treasures, together we set sail. With no maps to guide us, we steered our own course. Weather the storms when the winds were gale force. Sat out the doldrums with patience and hope. Working together, we learned how to cope. Life is an ocean, but love is a boat. In troubled waters, it keeps us afloat. When we started the voyage, there was just me and you. But now, look around us, we have our own crew. Together we're in relationship, built with care to last whole trip. Our true destination's not marked on a chart, but we're navigating for the shores of the heart. Life is an ocean, but love is a boat. In troubled waters, it keeps us afloat. When we started the voyage, there was just me and you. But now, look around us, we have our own crew. Life is an ocean, love is a boat. In troubled waters, it keeps us afloat. When we started the voyage, there was just me and you. But now, look around us, we have our own.